You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have a special guest, Melissa Doogie Spires. She is an award-winning essayist, a screenwriter, an advocate for topics of religious and narcissistic abuse. And she utilizes her online platforms, TikTok, Instagram, etc., to be able to educate and to offer also some prevention. Her memoir, Holy Disobedience, won the 2021 Book Pipeline Unpublished Nonfiction Manuscript Prize, with excerpts featured in the Huffington Post. Melissa's writings appear in magazines nationwide, and she's a contributor to Take the Fruit, an anthology of religious trauma. Also a runner, and as she says, a cheese lover, which I respect, and lifelong vintage collector, also very cool. Melissa holds a BA in English literature from Barnard College at Columbia and is based in California. Her book, Holy Disobedience, recently came out, and the book's description says that it's a gripping and unflinching story about growing up in the shadow of control and silence and secrets within the strict fundamentalist Seventh-day Adventist Church. When Melissa learns that her father, a respected pastor, was a serial child predator shielded by the church, her world implodes. Our conversation was a wonderful one. I hope to be able to talk to her again. She's working on some new projects, so I told her to come on back whenever those come out. Here's Melissa now. I am delighted to have Melissa Doogie Spires with us today. I am not only excited to talk to you and to talk about your book, Holy Disobedience, love the title, but also to be able to talk about a group that seems to have evaded us. I'll take responsibility for that. It's not something that I've jumped into. It's not something that's actually been presented to us as something to talk about, something that fits within the rubric of this show. And so it is really important to not only have someone come who has expertise about a group, but who can say, from the inside, this is what I experienced. And from the inside, I saw the system itself protect someone, protect something that it shouldn't have protected or it shouldn't continue to protect. And that is a really important piece of this. And so I look forward to our entire conversation today. And so I'd love you to take a few moments just to introduce yourself, and then we will start talking.
Sure. My name is Melissa Doogie Spires, and I am the author of Holy Disobedience here. We'll talk about that toward the end. But it is a story of my growing up in the Seventh-day Adventist church, which I call the biggest church no one knows, which you kind of touched on there. I was a fourth-generation Adventist and left at about 18, but the deconstruction process has been multi-step. And figuring all of the indoctrination I had in various destructive ways and how it had played out even in my secular life. So there's that piece. To go to the biggest church no one knows piece, which you're not at fault for not having covered it. I mean, no one knows about them. They are approximately 4 times larger than the Mormon church worldwide. 4 times larger. They have about 25 million members worldwide. They're secret. Nobody knows of them. So they would call themselves a standard Protestant Christian organization. I call them a lot of names, but they are an end times cult. They have extreme indoctrination, cult control, behavioral thought, information control. So we'll get to cover that.
Oh, yes, we will. Okay. I was telling you before, living here in Los Angeles, I pass by the Seventh-day Adventist Church quite a bit on my route along Ventura Boulevard. And it is beautiful. It's big. I see lots of people, lots of cars in the parking lot. It's active, very active. And there isn't a sense about what it is, but I think that there is something really interesting about when you have the presentation that feels mainstream, that is what seems like another denomination, but really is its own entity with its own governing body. So then it's insular. And what that can mean too is that then there are fewer protections because everything stays in-house. And also I want to talk about something being an end times group and what that does psychologically, emotionally. We've talked to other guests about how they were involved in groups where they talked about the end times, Armageddon, fires of hell coming up through the sidewalk cracks and what to do to prep, what that does to your psyche, how many nightmares you can have from that, the hypervigilance, what it does to your whole system, not only psychological, but physiological system. So there's a lot to cover. So I would love to have you decide where you want to begin talking. Go for it.
I guess I can kind of just give a little tiny history of the Adventist Church. The Mormons, the Adventists, and the Jehovah's Witnesses came out of the exact same history with what was called the Millerite movement in the mid-1800s. There was a man, William Miller, who thought that Jesus was coming back in 1844, October of 1844. And when that did not happen, the Mormons had split off from that a little bit earlier. They had their own trajectory. But when that didn't happen, there were all these splinter groups. And the Adventists came from that. I believe the Jehovah's Witnesses split off a little bit later than that. But anyway, there were all of these kind of end timesy Jesus is coming back in our lifetime groups that were then scrambling to figure out why it didn't happen in October of 1844. And the Seventh-day Adventists had a prophet named Ellen White, which is very interesting since they to this day do not ordain women, but their prophet was female. And she got hit in the head with a rock when she was 9. And it caused her to have lifelong seizures, visions, hallucinations, etc. And she very early on, she wasn't even 20 by the time that she had claimed that was God's speaking to her. And she was one of the figureheads at that point of the Advent movement that became Seventh-day Adventist, or that was the Seventh-day Adventist by the time she was in her late teens. So the Adventists, like I said, they call themselves just average Protestants. But the things they think set them apart is that they worship sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. They have a health message, which is huge where you live because that's where their medical school is, Loma Linda. And that's part of the blue zones, the Adventist health message, blah, blah, blah. But that started way back in the 1800s with Ellen White and with John Harvey Kellogg, who was the cereal guy. And he was part of the founding of the Adventist Church. He was part of the health message. There's an excellent movie called The Road to Wellville about him that starred Anthony Hopkins and, oh, I don't know, a slew of stars. He was a weird dude. He was terrified of sex. He never had sex. He developed his cornflakes as a mode to dampen lust. If you ate high fiber, tasteless foods, it was supposed to dampen lust so that you would never have sex. He was also obsessed with controlling masturbation. Ellen White was obsessed with controlling both. I often say that the Adventist Church was founded on the fear of sex almost more than anything. And it's really true to some extent. And they have carried that through the sexual control, high control part to the present day. They were the ones who founded or were instrumental in founding conversion therapy. It was an Adventist pastor who started all of the conversion therapy groups in the United States. They were actually involved from Kellogg's time into the 1960s. They were involved in circumcision of both boys and girls to prevent masturbation, so female genital mutilation. And currently, they are very instrumental in anti-LGBTQ movements, politics. They were instrumental in getting the gay death law in Uganda passed. I know I'm kind of bouncing all over the place, but it's trying to give kind of a umbrella picture of the high control elements that started in the beginning and have continued to this day. So they have one of the largest medical systems in the world, Advent Health now. It's the umbrella organization. They have one of the largest education systems in the world. So they open schools all over the world. There are dozens of Adventist universities. There's a medical school, in fact, more than one probably, I think, at this point. And so that is how they have traditionally grown. Their organization is by aggressive colonial style missionary work, sweeping into underserved communities and offering medical care, education, etc. And then they get all these loyal Adventists and they, in the meantime, just decimate local cultures because everything is pagan and evil and from the devil that isn't Adventist. So it's quite destructive as well as bringing basic services.
Wow. Okay. Right. So let's jump in there. And I want you to be able to certainly continue. And I want to hear more about the education system so people know if they're signing up for a school that is sponsored by this organization or that in some ways they're supporting it by going to the school. I want people to know about those names. But in the meantime, it is just fascinating to hear about the birth of conversion therapy through this group, the anti-LGBTQ, the death legislation in Uganda, the circumcision for both. It's so disturbing. But also, I was thinking as you're going through the list, wow, they stand for everything I don't. It is so against my moral code Boom, boom, boom. Just as you're going through this list, and I'm sure there's more. It's one of those, but wait, there's more. I could tell, like, this is just the top couple so far. And I would love to hear more about what they stand for. So people also know when they are supporting them, what they're also supporting.
Yes. And they are, as well as being just the biggest church that no one's heard of, like in general, like people just haven't heard of them. But then even when you do hear of them, it's quite calculating. I've heard from many people within the organization or freshly left that they were told not to reveal they were Adventist when they are doing seminars, revival type seminars, when they're handing out Adventist literature, and particularly the schools. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because there is a whole subset of Adventist, particularly boarding academies in the United States and Canada, that it seems very intentional, obscure the fact that they are associated with Adventism. They just call themselves Christian, God-centered. On their websites, they don't say it's Adventist anywhere. And you'll find that often, again, with the missionary seminars when they invite people to come to. Often it will be health clinics, again, like stop smoking clinics. My father used to run a lot of those. And they're very soft, peddling Adventism without saying what it is. And it's very interesting, because the people that I've heard who were in those missionaryizing sectors, I never did any of the missionary stuff, so I didn't have personal experience, but people who've come out of it say that they are very much told, do not say that you're Adventist, because people have the wrong idea about us. They think we're a cult, and they won't be open to your message. And it's like, if you have to protest and you have to do an end run around that before the information's even presented, maybe you're a cult.
Right. If it quacks like a cult. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Interesting. So it doesn't make people suspicious. It makes people suspicious of the others who are going to be against them for sharing what they're involved in, as opposed to it doing what I think it should do, which is to say, they've already said the word cult. Most organizations don't need to actually say that word ever. Let me look, let me take a deep dive. But I guess people might feel like they're doing something anti-Christian by really researching the group and finding out what's been written or exposed about it.
Yeah. And that is a very explicit part of both Ellen White, the prophet's message, and just the general organizational attitude is questions are from, that's the Satan working within you. If you're questioning, if you believing your own understanding, Ellen White had dozens of ways of putting it. Just basically, don't ask questions. If you're questioning me or the church, it's the devil. There is definitely no belief in critical thinking in the Adventist church.
No, that is so interesting. And so let's talk about the education and schools, and I feel like you're able, probably in a way that I'm not, to mention the names of the schools and other things to be cautious about, because this is your experience. This is your lived experience. So let us know what schools to be aware of.
Well, unfortunately, the list is so long. There are literally several dozen, at least, Seventh-day Adventist academies. There are also many, many, probably hundreds at this point, elementary schools. And that's just in the U.S. There's also Canada. They're all over the world, literally. I went to an Adventist college for a postgraduate high school year in Austria. There's a college in London. There's a college in France and in Spain. They're all over the place. I would really encourage people to look up Adventist if you're considering, because it's sneaky. And I mean, I could list all day long, but you can go to the Adventist websites and they will list their affiliated schools, even if the school doesn't say it is itself. There is also a whole branch of the Adventist Church, and this is, again, super important if anyone's considering schools for your kids. You also want to go look at Adventist self-supporting schools. And those are some of the worst, with the worst abuse records and the most fringe conservative Adventist, like they go off a little at the deep end, some of them, because they can claim, it's a very clever strategy. The self-supporting part is that the Adventist Church is not officially affiliated with them. They don't officially funnel Adventist funds into those schools, but they are Adventist with all of their doctrine, all of their everything, their staff, their everything, and they supposedly self-support. Basically, it's child labor. They require huge labor from the kids who go there. But also, I think it's private donations and also some probably backdoor Adventist funding. I know there are a couple ways that that can happen. Most famously, the most recent one was Miracle Meadows, which was a boarding school in West Virginia, which was being investigated by CPS for almost, I think, 20 years. And eventually, just a few years ago, it got shut down and a huge lawsuit was brought. And it was the largest settlement of its kind in West Virginia for school abuse situations. And the reason it took them so long to investigate and prove that all of this abuse was going on in that Adventist self-supporting school was that every time CPS and investigators would get close to having information and going to the school to interview staff, the staff would be unavailable. They were from the mission field. They went to the mission field. Nobody knew where they were. I've heard of that in a couple of Adventist Academy abuse cases. So again, for people who are looking at Adventist schools, definitely do your research. Look at self-supporting schools. Look at the Adventist websites, not just the school website. There are a lot of academies that are not boarding schools. I went to one that was just a day academy, and I ended up getting a very good education, but I think that's probably not the standard.
Okay, not the standard, right? And you also wonder if there is a standard, because they can do their own thing, right? So what do standards mean? And also, you wonder about CPS. I often wonder about CPS. Even though, yes, I don't want to defame, they are there and they can help protect and they jump in sometimes when others don't. But also, you want them to notice that if people keep hiding, then it's because they have something to hide.
Yeah.
If they don't, they would be there and say, come in and look. There is nothing here that is problematic. But instead, oh, I have a thing over there with the, I have to get my car washed. It just seems a little, actually, more than suspicious.
Yeah, totally.
Right? And you just wonder why that went on for so long. But that's a whole other frustration and show. I also want to get back to this person who is this prophet, this woman who was not able to, I guess, change things within the patriarchal group so that men are still the ones in charge, even though it was fostered by this woman. When you talk about her being hit in the head and having seizures, I can't help but think about my colleague, Dr. Yuval Laor, who has studied something called temporal lobe epilepsy.
Yes.
Right. And it comes to mind now to you, too, like, that there is this thing that I really want people listening to this to look into, because it can cause people to feel that God is speaking to them. And it really is its own form of seizure disorder, where people might not even remember the next day after they were on their soapbox, sometimes literally on a street corner, pontificating or with their signs, and feeling like this is a conversation that God is having with them, or that they're being given a role or a task that they need to further in this world. But it all comes from a brain disorder.
Yeah, there is a growing number of people within even Adventism and certainly outside of Adventism who are now pointing out, of course, she had a traumatic brain injury. I mean, it's very clear. She was in a coma for several weeks. Everything just lines up. And there's even further a syndrome called Geschwind syndrome, which comes with temporal lobe epilepsy and injuries. She ticks every box for that. All of the symptoms, it's hyper-religiosity, hypergraphia, writing all the time. She wrote so much. She also plagiarized a ton, but still, she was prolific in her writings. It comes with what they call abnormal sexuality. In most Geschwind syndrome people, it's a low sexual desire or appreciation. In occasional ones, it's hypersexuality, but she obviously had hypo and hated it. There's circumstantiality and there's hyper-focus. And people also often say that what comes with a temporal lobe injury is a lack of joy, grim, no joyfulness. And I tell you, Ellen White, when you read her writings, I mean, the woman is such a downer. She's such a killjoy. She is so grim and dour and just, ugh. It all lines up. And it just seems like, well, of course, she was hurt. She was severely injured, but not a good basis for starting a religion.
No, it is not. I remember hearing this Dr. Yuval Ohr talking about where there was a study done to see if people had this. And they would send them, and you've probably read all about this because I haven't learned about this Geschwind syndrome. So thank you for that. I love learning about new things. So I'm going to definitely do a deep dive.
It's fascinating.
I'm sure it is fascinating. This is why I'm probably not invited to as many parties as I would like, because I talk about this sort of thing.
Have you heard about Geschwind syndrome?
Oh, right. Exactly. Thanks for the drink. Have you heard about Geschwind syndrome? Okay, so people are like, no, please no.
Right, exactly. Oh.
Look at the time.
Right.
Sorry, that's me. But what I also find so interesting is that in this study that they did where they sent out a questionnaire to see if people had certain syndromes and symptoms of this, when you talk about the hypergraphia, and of course, I think about people like L. Ron Hubbard, who was like publishing book after book after book after book.
Yes.
And also talking.
I think he had a brain injury too, did he not?
I wouldn't doubt it, but I have to look into that. That's a very interesting thing. I don't know. And it can also come from having, you can have physical manifestation. You can also have it be not only from an injury, but high fever. I mean, there are a lot of things that can cause this, and illness can cause it, even though if you're a Scientologist, you're above illness, whatever that means. It's a great sound to go along with that statement. But that they could tell if people had it even before opening up what they sent back in the envelope, they could just see how thick the envelope was that they got in return, that it was just a few pages of questions. But if they got back basically what looked like a novel, they're like, we don't even have to open it. We just know already that someone couldn't stop. And it was fascinating just to see the volume. And what also happens within controlled and controlling and manipulative environments is that you're faced with what I call a wall of words. Someone is just talking. You can have this impression that what they're saying is important by the sheer volume of it. And if they can go on for 7 hours, it must have been important. There is no correlation in terms of importance or relevance, or even if it makes sense or not, and volume.
Absolutely. And she did all of that. You are so right, not only in her writing, but she was famous for holding a Bible above her head. Everyone says it was just amazing. It was a miracle because she was so frail and weak, but for hours and hours, and preaching for hours and hours and hours, 7 hours, whatever. Which I also love to point out, and the Adventists just don't like it at all. But that was also a David Koresh thing, and the Branch Davidians and David Koresh had come from Adventism as well. Yeah, it's a classic cult leader thing. Just snow people, wear them down with hours and hours and hours of your bullshit.
Right. But then to add to it, often people are admonished. Children are admonished for not sitting still, for falling asleep, for needing a bathroom break. All of the control and the abuse around that is also what people are really left with and are damaged by.
Very much so. Yeah, we were certainly very highly controlled. And Ellen White, she did not seem to like children at all, even though she had some. She wrote terribly mean, awful, psychologically cruel and abusive letters to her young sons about how God doesn't love cranky children. And if you're cranky, you will be left out of heaven. You won't be able to join everyone and you'll ruin heaven for everybody. And she was extremely awful. And I know that Victorian culture in general was not terribly kind to children, so I can't blame her fully. but she was particularly awful about children. And so, yeah, we were expected from the age of diapers to be able to sit through an entire church service of a couple of hours and be absolutely silent and not need anything. Swallow your needs.
Wow. Swallow your needs. And I guess literally with Kellogg, swallow your needs.
Yes.
Ingest enough fiber so you don't have sexual drives. I don't also. There are so many things where I'm just wondering about the connection. And I'm sure it felt like it made sense at the time. I would love then to shift over to having you talk more about your own experience, your own experiences at home and what it was like for you. And also to not, from what I can see and from what I've read, to not have a system around you that protected you. There was sort of nowhere to go to say, look what's happening and can you help me? Which is highly isolating and frightening for a child. So let's shift over to talking about that. And then I want people to then hear more about your book and find out more about where they can find all the things that you're putting out there. Let's find out about you as a little one.
As with every religion, there was a spectrum of liberal to conservative. And I would say we were raised in the conservative end of Adventism, but in the normal conservative end. My dad had gone to the Adventist seminary. He was a youth pastor when I was young. And then he also went to the Adventist medical school. So then he was a doctor through most of my conscious life. So there is a very patriarchal structure in Adventist homes. My dad was the head. My mother was in charge of the children. We were supposed to obey mother implicitly. She was extremely controlling, and we found out later partly why, but it was also at the behest of my father and Ellen White. We were homeschooled. When I was growing up, it was still kind of a fringe thing to do. Ellen White advised that children should stay with their mothers as long as possible. So my parents interpreted that as homeschooling. But then we went to Adventist schools then from about fourth grade, third or fourth grade onward. And then I left Adventism after I graduated from Adventist high school. My sister went all the way through the Adventist college system. But growing up, the general cultural control that Adventists exert that isolates you completely is you are taught to fear anyone who's not Adventist. It's a very persecution-based religion. Everyone is out to get you. And especially in the end times, people will be torturing you. I mean, I developed a bedwetting habit for the first 6-8 years of my life, partly because they would tell us that we were going to be tortured and chased into the hills and our parents would be killed in front of us. People would be torturing us for worshiping on Saturdays. We were also terrified of eating anything wrong. Adventists are vegetarian, but there are also, along with the health rules about Kellogg's fiber stuff, there was no spices. We didn't even have pepper or mustard in our house because those were also supposed to inflame lust. Anything spicy was going to like incite your bodily excitement. And no caffeine, obviously no alcohol, no smoking, all that stuff. But also, we had no television. We had no radio or popular music. So news was very limited. We weren't allowed to go to the movies. No dancing. Drums were from the devil. If any music had a drum beat, that was the way the devil got your soul, which is also extremely racist.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
So we were raised, I like to always say that we grew older, but we never grew up because we had no experiences. And then on top of that, so in school, you started with chapel, which was 20 minutes or so of worship. And then at least in high school and some in junior high, we had an hour of religion every day, but that was just Adventist stuff. We didn't learn about anybody else. And then for us, in our family, we had family worship every night. And then on the Sabbath, which is observed from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, you really weren't allowed to do anything but worship God. So we had no competitive sports. in high school or anything because you couldn't compete on Saturday. Plus, Ellen White said competition was a horrible thing. So we grew up in this bubble, basically cult compound, but no walls. We were afraid that anything we did, every sin had the same weight. So if you rode your bike on Sabbath, you were afraid you were going to hell. If you kicked a puppy, it would have carried the same weight as eating mustard. Everything was terrifying, and you thought you were going to go to hell for everything. Then there was this fear that Jesus could come tomorrow, and you guys are all going to be persecuted for worshiping on Saturday. Talk about hypervigilance, just really extreme hypervigilance. Your nervous system never rested. And then we had on top of that family stuff that my mother was so viciously protective of my sister and I that we didn't even get to go on sleepovers. We didn't get to have play dates. We didn't get to join. The Adventists have this thing called Pathfinders. It's like a Girl Scout, Boy Scout hybrid for Adventist kids. And they had little sashes and they earned little badges and they got to go on camping trips. And it sounded really exciting. When I was a kid, I wanted to be normal, but we weren't allowed to do that either. And we weren't allowed to go to any of the Adventist summer camps or anything. So when we talk about my book, we'll talk about how we found out a little bit about that. I mean, growing up, we just thought my mom was awful. And then we found out why she had been controlling us so much.
Right. The why is always so important. Even though the outcome can be the same.
Is the same. Yeah.
Right. But still, you can have a little more awareness and take it less personally. It's not like you were not able to be controlled or you were not able to be trusted. It's that your mom came to this for whatever reason that we'll get into. But sometimes that does help to depersonalize it so that you're not the one thinking it was because of me that I couldn't go to Pathfinders. What I find so interesting is when you were talking about this, that you were so controlled, so held, but without walls. Even though children do have a sense that they have walls, because where else are they going to go? But still, it feels like, because you've used the word fear and afraid, terror, the walls seem to be made of fear. That if you can make someone afraid of themselves, of their own drives, of the world, of their parents being killed by outsiders, being terrorized by people outside, fearing the entire rest of the world, that sets up a pretty solid wall for quite some time. And even after, it's hard when the walls come down, but only to a certain degree. It's almost like you still have to test to see, am I safe? Am I going to get attacked or hit by lightning? Or what is going to happen if I take this risk? So the walls stay up. I want to say they become more permeable after a while, but you still see remnants of it that you have to push through. That takes years and years and years of doing. It's really quite an incredible thing. So there were things also that happened within your home that were different from what happened in other homes. There was more control. There was more limitation. And so it was you and your sister. Was there anyone else in the household?
So, yeah, it was me and my sister. So we had the traditional Adventist girl upbringing. I partly knew all the way along, but I've certainly learned since that boys were treated completely differently. I mean, we had, before the term purity culture, we, of course, were raised in extreme purity culture. We just didn't have a name for it yet. And girls were much more tightly controlled in general than boys were. But particularly to do with anything with sexuality, which also meant where we could go, what we could do. You can't do that because it's dangerous for a girl. The boys just wouldn't be able to do, they wouldn't be under that umbrella. But we were particularly controlled in terms of what we wore, how we presented ourselves. You couldn't have bra straps showing. You couldn't wear sleeveless shirts. Your skirts at school had to be a certain level. And we would have a lot of special classes. It would usually be during work or week of prayer, but we also had a class called Marriage and Family where the girls would be pulled aside separately and we would be indoctrinated with this whole boys can't control themselves. Boys will get blue balls if you don't end up having sex with them. If you lead them on, don't ever start. Don't permit. Don't allow boys to touch you, to do whatever. And it was our responsibility. It all fell on us. And I've heard from many girls who obviously they didn't have the choice of whether to allow it or not. It was taken from them either by someone much older or a boyfriend who didn't respect boundaries or whatever. And so then they were still guilted with the same thing. It was their fault. So we were told all of the purity culture things that if you had sex or got physically involved in any way, basically you were useless. Female sexuality was your value. And so you protected that at all costs, which is part of why my mother was so vigilant for us. We were told the licked cupcake and the crumpled dollar bill. I talk in my book about how one of our religion teachers, his favorite thing was to say, girls, you don't want to be the wrinkled, stretched out, stained, sweated in shirt that's been thrown on the floor in the dressing room, do you, that other men have tried on? You want to be the shirt in the package, all brand new for someone to come purchase, basically. Like, oh, you want your sexuality to be brand new, to be bought by some man. You know, I mean, it was just, in hindsight, it's so vile. But that was the way girls were raised. And we were allowed to be educated, unlike some other really culty things that don't allow women to be educated. But we weren't really encouraged to want careers. We were basically really encouraged to go to college so you'd find a nice Adventist husband. And it would be okay if you were like a teacher or a nurse for a few years type of thing. But it wasn't really ever encouraged that we were going to be career people. We were going to grow up to be wives.
Right. And whatever you learned, I guess you could use for homeschooling for your children. Right. That's great. Also, interesting image about the crumpled up thing on the floor, because you think, well, what caused you to be crumpled up and on the floor? There's no sense of a causal relationship. Like somehow you don't just walk through life being that way. That's something that's done to you, but you are still supposed to be pristine. So like many things, like patriarchy in general, there isn't this awareness of teaching men to not be Neanderthals, basically. And there are men who I've talked to who said, I was not given the benefit of learning how to be kind and how to see a woman as a human being. And I didn't know that what I was doing was wrong. I thought this is what God expected of me, or I thought that all of my urges were things that other people just had to tolerate. And I never learned to control myself. And then I ended up doing things that I regret. So that there's a deficit for both genders, much more so, I think, for women, but also it negatively impacts men. There was also this interesting mic drop moment that happened, that little video that's going around, I think, by people in the manosphere, where they're asking women, do you want men to disappear? Well, no, not really. But okay, but what if there were no men around to protect you? And this one woman said, from whom?
Right, right.
We need protecting from men. So if there are not men around to protect, like it's the not understanding the beginning of the equation, only looking at the ending. So it can be quite maddening. And there are blinders on, I think, all around.
Yeah.
So this is the way you and your sister were taught.
Yeah.
That's scary.
I have heard from men also saying exactly the same thing, or that they felt so much guilt still that even when they were married, they couldn't function. But we were told we were always supposed to satisfy once we were married. It was your job as a wife to satisfy men all the time, anytime. If he strayed, if he had an affair, that was your fault because you obviously weren't putting out enough. And so men were taught to believe that also, you know, and that's very destructive to them. There was a guy in my academy a couple of years ahead of me who was known to go around any girl that he'd heard had had sex or anything like it. He would literally try to assault them and succeeded in several occasions. And he told at least one girl that he was just testing to see if her purity was still intact. Like it was kind of his job to test. And I don't think he just made that up out of nowhere. I think that he really got that message, you know? So it's just, yeah, so destructive all the way around for everybody.
Right. Absolutely right. My goodness. Okay. So then I'm curious just through your teen years, how and when you left and just emerging in the world or into the world outside this, because I work with a lot of people who are what we call in the field SGAs, second generation cult members, and fourth generation also. So here they are as adults, not knowing how to be here. What does this mean? And can I trust myself? Can I trust the world? How do I make decisions? How can I learn to be independent? How do I learn to address all my concerns and worries and still function? For some people, it's insurmountable. And for others, it's just a heavy, heavy challenge. And they're either lucky enough to be able to connect with others or they have the internal strength to be able to do it. But it is quite a heavy burden. So I'm curious about your teen years and then moving into your time of leaving.
It is definitely a heavy burden. I feel a little fortunate because I left so early, so I didn't get married in the Adventist system and all that stuff that often makes it so much harder for people. But regardless, it is a lifetime of work. I don't think the work of becoming normal ever goes away. In high school, I slowly realized, and I wish I could point to an aha moment, but it was just a slow realization that I really didn't ever believe the whole Adventist thing. I didn't even really believe in God. It just gave me so many questions. It all seemed very hypocritical, illogical. None of it stacked up to me, but I knew that I was trapped. I knew I had no recourse. So I just kind of, eyes on the prize, focused on graduating and getting out. So from freshman year onward in an academy, I was obsessed with making good enough grades and learning enough about the outside world that I could go to a non-Adventist college. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know if my parents would support me or not, but that was my goal. I was getting out. And so I started going to the library, the public library when I could, and I started learning about the world. I read magazines as a way to like absorb short snippets of just pop culture and anything I could get my hands on. And I would read college catalogs because, of course, there's no such thing as online back then. By senior year, I decided, just literally switch flipped, and I decided, okay, the biggest control that they have on us right now is they're so afraid of sex. They're so afraid we're going to find out about sex. And so I'm going to find out about that. That's something I can do while I'm still trapped. It's my body. And I'd had all these body control issues all the way along. I'd had eating disorders. I was a cutter. I was pulling out my hair. I was, you know, because my body I knew was the only thing that I could keep from them. So I knew I couldn't experiment sexually within the Adventist system. It was too dangerous. So I had my driver's license at that point. I could lie and say I was going to a church service or something. And I went down to the local public school and I just started hunting for a guy that I thought was super cute. And I found one and I found out where he worked and I went in and I started a conversation. And 2 weeks later, I had ditched my virginity and I had done what they were so afraid of. So that was really my first proof to myself. The world is not going to kill me. I'm not going to hell. I was waiting to feel, they told us, like you're going to lose a piece of your soul every time you have sex with someone who's not your husband. You're going to imprint on him. And I was just like, see, look, it's just a physical action. It has nothing to do with anything. They're full of shit. I'm good to go now. So My parents did not support, in the beginning, my efforts to go to a non-Adventist college, and the schools control how you can apply anyway. They don't give you the SAT to get into most public or non-Adventist colleges. So my parents and I compromised, and I went to school in Austria for that year between high school and college, and got a lot of worldly experience there. We were allowed to just run around wherever we wanted on the weekends, even though it was a traditional boarding school during the week. So I took up drinking and smoking and had lots more sex and applied to other colleges from there so that I didn't have to deal with my parents. Ended up at Barnard College at Columbia University in New York City. My mother's parents, who were Adventist, but who had always paid for our private school education, they paid for me to go. So from then on, I was out. I was technically out. I never went back to an Adventist church, except for maybe a family funeral or whatever. I never went back to the town where I'd gone to Adventist high school. I was done. I was out. And for about 20 years, probably, I never even admitted to people my weird culty background, except for really, really good friends. And I just tried never to ever think about it. Just never. I just thought I was done. I thought that leaving equaled healing. I was out, free as a bird. So I'd gone to a good college. I tried being an actor for a while. I was a personal assistant for a while. I ended up as a textbook editor. I thought I was flying high. I was done. Life is great out here in the world. And then when I was about 35, my sister and I got phone calls from my dad saying, sit down, you need to hear this. And he told us that when he was a youth pastor, when we were very, very tiny, he had been caught in a series of molestations of girls in his youth pastoring and his Pathfinder leadering. He had been grooming and preying on a series of young teenage girls. The reason it had come out was because he'd been a doctor most of my life, but he'd retired very early and he went back to being a pastor as a retirement job. And one of those original teenage girls found out and called the Seventh-day Adventist Church administration and said, oh, no, no, he cannot be in a position of power over people. So that was huge in terms of actually kicking off my deconstruction and realizing that, I guess as part of that, I tracked down and befriended that woman. And I just said, you know what? I've been lied to all my life. I don't trust my parents. I don't trust the church. We'll never have trust of the church. Can you talk to me? And she and I became very good friends. So now that's been almost 20 years. And she, bless her, took about 10 years of me asking her for details. She would give me anything I wanted to know, but she kept being like, you really don't want to just focus on my story and your dad's story. You want to look at the big picture. And you are still, she never said this, but you are still broken. And you still need lots of deconstruction and reckoning. And look at the church. Look what they did. She was the first person who told me about the female genital mutilation because she had gone to the Adventist Medical School also. She pointed me to just really looking at the church, which I had never wanted to do. That's a very long-winded answer to say that my healing didn't really start for about 20 years. I thought I didn't need to. And then I really realized once that whole thing kicked off, it was at least a decade plus, and I'm still going through it, of realizing that all of my indoctrination from childhood had tracked through my adult life. I had dragged it with me like so much suffocating baggage. I had gone from the age of 22 onward, I had been in a series back to back of very controlling, very abusive relationships with older men. I had gone through sexually abusive stuff because I just was so intent on proving that there was nothing to sex. I had never learned to associate sex with love because they had taken that from us way, way before by making it such this huge thing with so much moral weight that I never learned to associate it with joy and love and connection and specialness. So there was all this indoctrination. I had no boundaries. I just obeyed everybody. I always looked for direction outside myself. I Yeah, thought everyone was an authority but me. And that was all that programming. So I did leave early, but I didn't really leave until way later, way later.
That is so interesting, and it is so common. I'm so glad this other woman was just open to talking things through with you, helping to guide you. A lot of people leave and find themselves in relationships where they forfeit. They forfeit a sense of self. They forfeit a say. They are looking for someone to guide them. They're not yet at a point where they feel like they can guide themselves and they can trust themselves. And I wonder what turned it around for you. Sometimes it's kind of a slow burn. It might not have been one event, but that made you think, I actually think I got this. I don't need to be led.
Again, I wish I could point to a watershed moment, but it really, like so many other people's stories, COVID, where I was sitting at home, I was still talking to, I'd call her Dr. Z in the book. You know, I had reconnected with her because everyone was on social media a lot. And she and I had kind of gone in waves where our friendship was too intense and we kind of took a break for a while. And she and I got back in touch during COVID and I started speaking out online about Adventism just because I wanted something to do. I started researching the hashtag ex-Adventist and realized that there were people out there who were talking about being ex-Adventist. I had never known any other ex-Adventist except my sister and some of my cousins, but we weren't close. So I started researching ex-Adventist. I started talking to Dr. Z again. She kept really pushing me to like really examine the church. I found the deconstruction hashtag, which I'd never even known there was a word for that. Oh my gosh, you need to deprogram yourself, basically. And then through that, I found the narcissistic abuse hashtag, and I started finding out all about that. And I was like, my gosh, my first abusive situation relationship was with the church and with my family. Now I'm in a really seriously abusive relationship, and I started looking at the relationship, and it just all literally was just a rabbit hole of just going down and realizing that none of it was okay and none of it was serving me, and I really had to look. And I kind of eventually ended up in sort of a self-induced nervous breakdown. I just quit everything. I got out of the relationship. I stopped drinking. I stopped doing anything that wasn't my mind being clear. I started meditating again. I bought all these self-help books. I just started all the things at once, just like consuming. And to an extent, that process is still ongoing and will be for life. It's not something I think you're cured of when it's so many layers of generational trauma plus religious trauma plus my own reinforcement of all of it for decades. And I've got a lot of undoing to do, but now it's a joyful process because I feel like I'm in control of it, or at least I guide it, and I'm on the right side of it. I'm on the upside of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, that's so nice. So nice to be able to say and to know. Before we switch over to talking about your book, I also just wanted an update on the organization itself and if it's still growing and if it has learned from anything that's happened in the past, et cetera, et cetera. Go for it.
Yes. Oh, thank you for asking, because it's a very exciting time, I think. The Adventists are losing control of their information control because of social media. There are people like me, vocal ex-Adventists, who are speaking out now. People have access to critical pieces. There's an organization called Adventist Today, which is definitely a very progressive, liberal, not funded by the church, so they can be independently critical. They just yesterday, or 2 days ago, published a really good article by a woman who came from a family of child abusers in the Adventist system. They invited me to come speak a few weeks ago. I got to speak about the Adventist abuse case because, as part of getting online during COVID, I started speaking out about abuse because I'm not a victim myself. So I feel like I'm not triggered and damaged severely by talking about it and holding space for all of the victims who are. But because I have an abuser in my family, it means so much to me to stand up for the victims. So that's a lot of what I do now online, is speak out against Adventist abuse. And In January, a huge lawsuit was opened against the church representing victims. So I've gotten to help publicize that, and I got to help provide them with some information. So things are changing in terms of at least how much the church is being presented with their abuse problem. Now, whether they are going to change anything to deal with it remains to be seen. They say they are. I'm not seeing it yet, but I'm hopeful. And their numbers, membership numbers within the westernized world have been falling for several decades, quite severely recently in the United States and Canada and Europe. But they are growing, unfortunately, very rapid fire in developing countries because of that whole medical system, school system, missionary work. They just sweep on in and literally sweep people off their feet with good works, and then they convert everyone and destroy the local culture. So that's an ongoing, in my opinion, problem, but they are still growing worldwide.
All righty. Okay, but still, we're going to focus on what's good and what is happening, and that people are now getting to have a sense of justice. Maybe there will be a little more protection in the future. Even if the reason that there is protection is that people in the organization don't want to get into trouble or they don't want media attention or whatever else, even if it's still this external locus of control, I feel like, okay, we'll take it. So let's talk about your book and how it all began and the process and where people also can find it and also find you online. Go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can hold it up here again. My book is Holy Disobedience, Sex, Sin, and Secrets in the Biggest Church No One Knows. It can be found anywhere you buy your books, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can order it from your local bookstore, etc. There's an audio copy that I read myself, which is fun. There's an electronic version. So there's all that. And it basically details a lot of what we talked about my own life and journey and finding out about my dad and then becoming an advocate. And the process of deconstruction and how I'm hoping people walk away from it hopeful, even though it's a very dark story in parts, but, and that life is messy. Life is complicated and sharp-edged, and religion sells us easy answers and black and white, right and wrong, just so packaged neatly, and just the binary. We're supposed to buy into that. And I hope what people take from my story is the grace to be able to live where there's bad in the good and there's good in the bad. That's human. And religion, to an extent, vilifies our humanity. And to be human is just a big mess. And it's beautiful, you know? So I've heard from many people that Adventists are happy to see an ex-Adventist presented because no one really does that. But it also applies to pretty much anyone who was raised evangelical or high control. I've heard from a lot of Mormons who identify with it, all of that. So hopefully it will give validation to lots of people for the weird upbringings that so many of us had.
Oh, that's incredible. And I wonder also about feedback. When people put things out there, and it's an organization that doesn't want to be on the radar, they have existed for a long time being under it, you can sometimes get pushback. You can sometimes hear things that are difficult to hear. In these situations, it's like adding insult to injury, sometimes quite literally. And then you also get feedback that is wonderful and affirming, but also connecting, and people don't feel alone. It's very hard to be one of the first voices in any movement, in any exposure. Sometimes people will wait also until someone else has said it first, and then they'll start feeling like they're brave enough to share their story. So I'm just curious about the reaction and what that's been like for you.
I anticipated a lot of Adventist apologists. I mean, I've been dealing on social media now for about 6 years with violently angry, defensive Adventists in my comment section. And so I was expecting exponentially more of that. I'd say that the critics have kind of stayed at the same level. There are definitely Adventist defenders. There are also a lot of people, we'll probably have them in the comment section here, that say, that's not Adventist. She's not truly an Adventist. You know, the whole not really a Christian things because it wasn't their experience. Okay, I'm glad they're at least engaging and they're considering, even if they aren't ready to consider that maybe there are things outside their experience that they should look at. I had been expecting a much more organized pushback from the Adventist organization itself because they're very litigious and very controlling. That so far has not come, so that has been interesting. I guess what could they say about my personal story, right? It's my story. The things that I have found really so encouraging and wonderful have been the people, even my sister, whom I'm very close to, but she was very like, why do you want to talk about your sex life? Why do you put that out there? What in the world? And I had a lot of doubt still that I might have just been a freak outlier and no one would connect with this. And I would just be, they might connect with the church parts or the school parts, but no one would connect with my personal journey through the ugly personal stuff, the sex, the all of that, the narcissistic control. And that's been the part that people respond to the most so far has been people, and not just women, but men, and not just Adventists, but other religions have been saying, like, I feel seen. I've never heard anybody talk about going into kind of the kink and abusive sexual pipeline from purity culture. I feel like you were a fly on the wall for me. And that is just so, I get goosebumps even talking about it because I know what it's like to feel like you're the only one. And now people can see it and hopefully they know that they're not the only one. And if I can provide that and that's it, that makes me so, so happy. But I also, like you said, I toss this off, but I really mean it. Like, I hope in 5 years, I am forgotten. I'm obsolete because there are so many ex-Adventist voices out there. People who went through conversion therapy, for instance, or people who were missionary-ized in that weird controlling, here, we'll dangle medicine and education if you become Adventist. There are so many ex-Adventist experiences that need to be talked about. People need to be exposing this church cult. I really hope now people can see that you can do that and you're okay. It's okay. There is connection and validation and support and community and growth and healing there. I hope it opens the floodgates.
I hope so too. And I love that idea of you being the one that sort of opened the door and that you're hoping that it just has its own momentum moving forward and it makes a difference and it makes a change, but it still takes bravery to be one of the first. When you're talking about kink and people really exploring themselves, there was someone who was on the podcast a number of years ago who talked about being raised in, basically eventually to become, I think, a sister wife. She was wearing long prairie dresses, and that was her life. And when she left the community, she got involved in kink culture. It wasn't even so much that she wanted that kind of sexuality as much as she was needing to be able to have a say, that when she said no, the other person listened. That was so huge. It was this huge watershed moment for her. She then also realized that you can find that in a nice partner who respects you. And so you don't have to feel like you have to go from kind of a marginalized community to a marginalized community, even though if that's what you want, that's what you want. Great. But she was also feeling like, okay, I keep being on the sidelines of things and I kind of just want a relationship. And to know that someone hears me and cares about what I say.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
it was very cool.
I love that. I'm going to go back and look for that episode now.
Yeah. 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 She was very, very cool talking about it. She said, I just needed to know my no meant no. And that's built into the system. And that if someone doesn't listen to you, there's something wrong with them, not with you.
Oh. I love it. I love it.
It's very cool.
What a clean, clear-cut way to like learn it and like embed it literally in your body, like change body's programming. Wow. Love.
I have a say, I have words, I have rights. It's monumental. It shouldn't be monumental. You should be able to have an upbringing that already fosters that. But that is not the case for a lot of people. And it's not the case for a lot of people in a lot of countries, like countrywide.
Yes.
When we hear about stories, it's very hard. Okay. So just as we're finishing up, tell us about anything else where people can find you, or if you have anything else online, or if you're working on something new, whatever's going on.
Sure. I'm working on a couple new books in discussions with my publisher. So definitely I encourage people to follow me online, buy the book. If you like it, follow me because there's more stuff coming. I am on Substack as just my author name, Melissa Doogie Spires. I am also very active on Instagram and TikTok. And that handle is, I do have a writer account on Instagram called Melissa Doogie Spires Writer. That's just literally little writing updates and kind of lifey things. But my religious trauma account, and where I mostly talk about holy disobedience, is TikTok and Instagram at The Glory Hole. And that is spelled W-H-O-L-E. You want to make sure you get that W in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? Important, right?
Important.
But I love the play on words. Yeah, totally. Awesome. All about that. Okay. All right. Well, it has been so good to talk to you, so enjoyable to talk to you, but also so important to have you open this world up to us and to have people really see and to have people know what they're driving by or what school they're enrolling in or what medical center they're going to and health, anything that they might be supporting. This is to just have people know what is behind the curtain. And also, I think with a hopeful message that with more light being able to be shined on these organizations, people hopefully down the road will feel more protected and really feel like their experience mattered and matters. So thank you so much, Melissa, for your time and all that you're doing.
Thank you for having me. This has been so much fun.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Yeah, fun for me too. So let me know when you have something else coming up. Feel free to come back and we'll talk again.
Awesome.
One more thing before you go. I think about something a lot. I think about a lot of things a lot. But something that I talked to Melissa about finding out who is starting an organization, why they're starting it, what the philosophy is about, why they care about those things, what's causing them to have this kind of fear about things, to have an edict that is so strict about it. And also, when we talked about her mother, why her mother made certain decisions limiting Melissa and her sister from doing certain things. When we do counseling, when I do counseling, I try not to make it be just behavioral. And what I mean by that is, if I'm working with a family and they say, fix my kid is a whatever, my kid's a troublemaker, my kid's a liar, my whatever, I will often say, let's meet as a family for a few times first, which they sometimes are open to, sometimes not. And part of the reason that I do that is that I want to find out what it's about, why a child is doing what they're doing. And it could be that they were born into the world with a certain kind of wiring. I'm fine. But more often, it is in reaction to a certain kind of environment, certain kind of parenting, or the combination between their personality and the parent's personality that sometimes just doesn't gel, doesn't do well in certain kind of moments. And like something I've talked about on the podcast before, when people are called liars or they themselves know that they lie, and the response is a punitive one, a behavioral one. Well, if you lie, then you can't go play whatever. Or if you lie, you don't get dinner, which is terrible, but that does happen. If you lie, you're going to have something taken away. If you lie, then we can never trust a word you say from here on in. And what often gets overlooked is why it's happening. What is happening within that child that's making them panicked about telling the truth, or making them feel like if they tell the truth, they're going to get in trouble because they've learned that's what happens. So it's actually a wise adaptation for them to lie, even though they wish they didn't have to, but telling the truth will be punishable. So it's only smart then to go a different direction. When you are noticing, for example, as Melissa was talking about, the origins of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, why it is that they had all these rules about diet, why they had rules about sex, why they had rules about so many things. You want to look at not only certain religious teachings and fundamentalist teachings, but you want to look at who started it all, what fears they had, maybe what disorders they had, what hangups they had, what things made them anxious. Because if someone doesn't own their stuff as their stuff, they will make it your stuff. They will find a way to have it permeate your life. A parent who is anxious about something will often want you to be anxious too. Like if they're scared of certain things happening to them, they'll want you to be scared of that too. Not always, but a lot of the time, because they're assuming that if they do whatever it is, let's say they're afraid of hiking, they're sure they're going to fall. They're sure there's going to be an avalanche. They're sure whatever it is, whether it's realistic or exaggerated. So then if you say, hey, mom, hey, dad, I'm going to go hiking, you might hear, you might hear one of those sounds, or you might hear them say, do you know all the things that could go wrong? Because they want to keep you safe, because they assume that's not safe for them. So sometimes the intention is for protection. But what you hope is that when someone becomes an adult, and it doesn't often happen, and I can say as a parent, I'm probably guilty of some of these things too. But you hope that someone at some point says, I feel like I am letting my issues become other people's issues. There is this thing that I am just afraid of. There's this thing that I can't handle. There's this thing that's difficult for me. And so I've decided to be against it, or I've decided that it's something that no one should have to deal with, no one should have to struggle through. And when you realize that you end somewhere and another person begins, meaning you don't have to instruct them based on your fears. You don't have to instruct them based on your past trauma, that you can call it what it is and you can say, this is my issue, but it doesn't have to be yours. Or this is from my history, but that doesn't have to be your future. Then you free people to be able to be themselves and to have that freedom. When we talk about cults, when we talk about controlling environments, relationships, family systems, very often when you want to understand why you were taught something, that you were taught to avoid doing anything, or you were taught that something is dangerous, you are learning a lot about the leadership. You're learning a lot about who started it all. Or you're learning a lot about the person who is saying it to you rather than it being a fact in your life. If it is something that is kind of natural, a natural reaction, like if someone says, if you don't wear your seatbelt while you're driving, something could happen to you because I was in a car accident when I was young and I wasn't wearing a seatbelt and I got a head injury. Fine. That is completely reasonable. But if someone then goes on to say, all cars are evil, and even if you put your seatbelt on, it's probably going to become detached and you're going to get a head injury, they're going beyond what is sort of logical and expected within that situation, and they're imposing their fears. They're imposing their trauma on you. And again, in those situations, it's to protect you. But within cultic systems is to control you. It's to make sure that you don't exercise your freedom, It's to make sure that you don't explore things in your life that they don't want you to. And the way, and we talked about this, Melissa and I, during our conversation, the way they often get you to do that is by instilling fear in you. And that is one of the most controlling methods of setting up a wall between you and the world and setting up a wall between you and yourself. Can you trust yourself? Are you someone who is going to do the right thing given a certain amount of freedom? You learn, no, you can't be trusted that you, as someone who is going against the edicts, that somehow you're going to do something wrong. And you'll never be able to come back from that, or you will always be punished by God for that. There are so many ways that people are controlled. If you're in a situation where there are just so many rules imposed on you, you want to take a step back if you can and wonder why it is that you're being made to feel you can't trust yourself, why you're being made to feel that you can't trust the world. And why you're being told that almost everything that you do is wrong and everything the world does is wrong. Because statistically speaking, that just can't be true. So you want to see it as diagnostic, not about you and not about the world, but about the person who is developing all these rules and all these punishments for not following them. It speaks volumes about them, not about you. Thank you so much to Melissa. I look forward to our next conversation. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections. And it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are 3 tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.